Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And on this rainy morning, we're bringing you more of our hot interviews with outstanding culinary professionals.
There we go.
Starting with Rick DeChance of the Rick DeChance Restaurant Group, which includes Tolga Sevdik. And Rick just opened a wonderful restaurant called Poulet Bleu, but he also won the position of semi-finalist in the James Beard Awards for Outstanding Restaurateur, which is a national award, although Rick's restaurants are all so far in Pittsburgh.
And Rick's, he's a story. He's a story and
he
a
is,
half.
He is.
Talk about a self-made restaurateur. And he's just done it one step at a time, and amazingly done a lot of the work himself. Not only in the kitchen, but in the design and the construction of the restaurant spaces themselves.
Yeah, he was so, garde-manger the other night at Poulet Bleu.
Rick's quite a guy and a good friend, and here's his story.
I want to thank you, Rick DeChance. Your restaurant group, the DeChance Restaurant Group, just became a semifinalist in this current James Beard Awards program for Outstanding Restaurateur. Now, that's a biggie. It's a national award. And, boy, you have a lot of competition there, but you came out very strong. And I think one of the reasons is, I mean, we just were at Poulet Bleu, your new restaurant in Lawrenceville. And it's a wonderful space. You do all this designing on your own. Tell us a little bit, in your own words, about your concept of Poulet Bleu and what you put into it, because you put a lot into it.
The idea behind Poulet Bleu is that, you know, I really wanted this casual French American, you know, bistro. I designed it around the kitchen, this open kitchen. I designed it with this gigantic island in the middle where it actually feels like you're in my home. You know, it's a smaller footprint than a lot of my other restaurants. The dining room only holds about 34. So I kind of designed it all around this kitchen, this beautiful Hessian range, the blue, the brass, and it really feels like you're connected with the chefs. It's more than just an open kitchen. It feels like you're actually inside my kitchen. So it makes it feel like every table is a chef's table because you're so close. You're right by the expediter, so you're really in touch with what's going on in this space. And wanted to keep true to like some bistro style cuisine with our own little take and flair on things. Heavy wine program and cool classic cocktails, French 75s and Sazeracs and things like that nature. But you know, it's been a balance of like keeping traditional to some degree and keeping simplicity, but then elevating in other areas where, you know, we want to push our creativity, you know, level. So that's about it.
You know what I think is going to be the toughest tables to get as Pittsburgh returns to normality in terms of spring and summer weather, and that's the tables outside.
Oh, they're wonderful.
They were fully occupied a couple of nights ago when we were there.
And it was a Tuesday night. Big restaurant night, Tuesday night, right?
Yeah, we put them out. It was, you know, I really wanted to just create that ambiance and, you know, start feeling that, because that space, we put the big French doors in the front of the space because we wanted to pull the indoor-outdoor, so it's just like this big flow. And we had a little burst of nice weather. I think it was like 70 degrees, and we're like, let's put the tables out, and people really enjoyed it. And having that courtyard in the front, I'm in the front of the space, and you know, the fountain, and
you put in a fountain, and you have gargoyles.
Gargoyles, and you know, I think my, you know, one of the things that I do great is the whole idea of the, you know, concept. So like the whole development of the design aspect of it, and really when you, a lot of people come to that place, they're like, wow, we feel like we're transported. We're not out of Pittsburgh. we're in another, you know, another city. We might be even in Paris or New York or something like that, because it doesn't feel like a traditional, you know, Pittsburgh restaurant. And we work really hard on trying to have everything cohesive, like the menu and the atmosphere, the music, the way the wait staff's dressed, all the little details, you know, like you said, the gargoyles, the big fountain, you hear the water out front, and, you know, the energy of the bar, and it, you know, most bistros are loud, and, you know, they're, you know, known for, you know, people watching and mirrors everywhere so you can watch everything.
Hey, we made friends just before we got into the front door, because this couple was sitting there from the North Hills, no less, and they had a big bowl of your frites. So,
yeah.
And I said, oh boy, those fries look good. And she said, why don't you have one? And so I did. So then Peter did too. So they later came in and visited us from the inside.
what really happened is she asked the people if she could have one of the
fries. I did not.
You did. Because you always do that.
Well, we're touching on the food here. And you have what's become almost legendary of your French onion soup, which I have to say is, I mean, I've had some really good onion soup, but this is like the tops.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think what's funny about this experience, like I said, it's very casual and it's very comfortable. I just had a bunch of people on last night, actually Chris Letang, Haglin, all from the Penguins, and they love it. But if they said, you know, they love all the my other restaurants, but this one you just want to really sit and relax and enjoy your space.
Oh, we had such a good time. Yeah.
Where some of the other ones are great, but, you know, they're busy, and they're packed and they're loud.
Oh, yes. Now tell us, by the way, because your award is restaurateur, which really implies not necessarily more than one, but it usually is more than one restaurant. And you have a string of them. Can you just run through some of them and just the name of the restaurant and the concept?
So Meat and Potatoes was my first restaurant.
No,
my first restaurant with Tolga Sedvik, which we opened.
Is a dream, by the way. Let's give credit to Tolga Sedvik, too, because he's fabulous.
Well, yeah, he's the backbone behind the operation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we're so successful because of, you know, our strengths and weaknesses. I take care of one thing, and, you know, he takes care of another thing. I know I can't do his job, and he really can't do my job. And we focus on what our strengths are, and, you know, I don't really worry about, you know, the back house and, you know, paying the taxes and all the business ends. And that's where, you know, he really comes into play. And I mean, without Tolga, I mean, I don't think it's impossible to be here, because the operations is, you know, the key to successful restaurant, you know.
Yeah, well, you single-handedly, though, reset the whole pulse of dining in downtown Pittsburgh, which is one of the things that everybody gives you credit for. And Meat and Potatoes was the first, and then it was Butcher and the Rye.
Butcher and the Rye. And then, yeah. So Meat was like our first home run, though. Meat was, so I came off of a fine dining restaurant. I knew I wanted to do something that was, you know, a little more Pittsburgh friendly, a little more casual, still trying to do good food, but like giving Pittsburgh, you know, good food at a, you know, good price in an unpretentious atmosphere, and just like a watering hole type of place. And that's where Meat and Potatoes came in play. And we, you know, we opened up with projections of, you know, what we thought we'd do. And our first, I think we were debt free in a month and a half.
It's so popular. You have crowd control guards at the door.
So popular. It was amazing. I mean, it was like pretty much like our first Academy Award. I mean, how many people, we're doing 450 covers a night in a 100 seat restaurant. And it's on that line. It's turn and burn. But it really, like you said, I think it's kind of sprung the whole downtown Pittsburgh dining scene, because before that it was kind of quiet. And next, you know, tons, you know, all these restaurants are coming downtown, seeing what, you know, the success of like a casual style dining atmosphere had in Pittsburgh. You know, everyone starts kind of jumping aboard, and now downtown is just thriving. Then after that, you know, I found a space, you know, around the corner called, we named it Butcher and the Rye. I knew I wanted to do something a little more farm-driven, a little more ingredient driven, which having, you know, meat and potatoes is so successful, but it's really hard to, you know, when you're doing, you know, 500 covers, like I said, 450, 500 covers a night, the really, the attention to detail is lost to some degree because it is a push. So we wanted to slow things down and we wanted to focus on one thing, which we decided on bourbon and whiskey and game. And, you know, we made a really, like, it's this kind of manly kind of restaurant scene.
Yeah, stuffed heads of animals on the wall and stuff.
A lot of taxidermy.
Yeah, taxidermy.
You know, dark velvet. You know, we kind of went after that easy type atmosphere. Chop housey still, heavy meat, heavy game, heavy bourbon.
A great bar program. Great.
Yeah, we're pushing probably about 1,000 bottles of whiskey right now.
Wow.
I think we have about almost $400,000 in inventory just in whiskey. But just trying to keep it, you know, and that's what we went after, and that was my second restaurant. And then from there, we opened up Taco. Taco, of course, our focus was on tacos, but not just, you know, just any tacos. We wanted to do something really special in Pittsburgh. We wanted to, we designed it where we put the kitchen in the front of the space, so it almost felt like a food truck type setting. Mm-hmm. Then we put the bar behind, so you actually have to walk through, like, see the kitchen, and then get into this, like, seedy, dark tequila bar. And our tacos range from real traditional, from, you know, pastor to carnitas, to more chef-driven, like our taco, which is our octopus.
Yeah, taco means octopus in Japanese.
In Japanese, is correct.
Different
so,
spelling.
That was our player on the name. Our namesake is Taco, T-A-K-O, which is our logo is the octopus. And so we have fun with it. On the other day, they did actually alligator tacos. We do, you know, a lot of vegetarian mushroom tacos, things like that. My favorite is Korean taco, chorizo taco. So it's completely different experience from the other ones. This one is more industrial. It, you know, when I think of tacos, I think of little seedy. I think of the streets. So we brought a lot of graffiti in and, urban setting. All the chandeliers, I actually made them all out of bicycle chains.
Yeah, that was cute. I like those.
So, like, it's about the experience for me. It's
yes.
Like trying to pull, like, when you're there, it's like, you know, it's dark, it's seedy, it's these, you know, it's bicycle chains and, like, all custom-made octopus tentacle lights. And it's about, like I said, it's about the whole field of space and the atmosphere and, you know, the experience is what we try to, like, pull together, not just coming in and eating and leaving. It's like every time you come to our places, it's whether it's the music, the service, the decor, the food, you know, we're trying to tie everything in as a whole. And
the thing I think I should mention too is that you have a crew of really talented chefs working with you, and so you sort of ease into partnerships with them and they take over some of these concepts as they're working on it, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I was so excited about the Restauranteur thing, because it's like not an individual. I mean, it's about the group, and I'm only as successful as, like, these guys make me. I mean, we are a group. This is a team. We're pushing a little over 300 employees right now, and, I mean, this is all of them. It's, you know, the Richard DeShane's Restaurant Group is everyone combined. So, I mean, I'm only, you know, luckily, you know, we have a core group of people that is really pushing us where, you know, we are today. And I think, I mean, that's the secret of my success is recognizing
their talent.
The talent makes me where I am.
And you've got a lot of them. You picked up Keith Fuller, too, for your next restaurant, which is a Texas Roadhouse called Pork and Beans.
Yeah, so me and Keith, you know, been friends for a long time. Keith is a celebrated local chef in Pittsburgh, came from Route 174. We've done a lot of different events together. As chefs, we always do different summer events and things like that. So it's always fun to work with a different chef to see their creative side and push each other and events together. And we always talked about, hey, we should do something. Or, you know, why don't we, you know, we're doing this only, you know, three times a year. Wouldn't it be fun to cook, you know, all the time? So we kind of found a space downtown and we decided to go with a barbecue-themed restaurant. It's a big space. It's probably my biggest space.
It's huge, yeah.
It is huge. It's our biggest space today, and you know, we wanted to. It's on the line of going to all the ballparks, PNC, Heinz Field, and so we kind of wanted to. We a big bar business in that area, so we kind of separated a little bit with the bar focus in the front. Half of it's the bar, heavy beer program in there. I think Space I Do has its own kind of cocktail. Like, that space is beer, butchered bourbon, taco is, of course, taco, and mezcals and rums, and Blue is wine.
How did you get to Lawrenceville? Because this is your first restaurant outside of downtown.
I've always had a little, you know, space in my heart for Lawrenceville. I love Lawrenceville. It's a cool little neighborhood vibe. I looked at it, actually, believe it or not, Pork and Beans was supposed to be in Lawrenceville. I looked at a space that a developer was building, and I signed of a intent on the lease, and the building actually is just getting built right now. But that was like 2 years ago. So we had our goal to be in Lawrenceville a few years ago, but it never happened, and then we pushed Pork and Beans downtown. But this space opened up. It used to be a restaurant. I walked through it. I liked the space. It was right next to Marcia. I'm good friends with Justin Severino. Mm-hmm. I just thought it'd be really fun to kind of be part of the action, what's happening in Lawrenceville.
Oh, it's a hot area. I mean, everybody nationally recognizes that. No, you haven't stopped, though. You have.
So, Rick, you're not done yet, right?
No, you're moving on. The next one is, what is it?
We are moving.
Do you have four more in the offing, or three more now that Poulet's open, right?
Yeah, three more now this year, actually. It's aggressive, but the way these lined up, it wasn't like I was like, I'm going to do this, and this. It's like, it was a slow thing. Like, I took the ones, I bought a building in East Liberty, was the old Salt of the Earth space.
Yeah.
It was.
That's Garfield.
Garfield. So I bought this space in Garfield with the old Salt of the Earth space, and the space itself was beautiful. That area is being developed, and it was just a smart play in my first, and it was my first building that I'm actually buying. Places I lease. So, you know, being downtown, I'm under gigantic parking garages and things of that nature. So, you know, you don't really own those buildings. So this came up, and it was my first building to buy, and I bought the lot next to it. I was pretty excited about it because, you know, before that, I'm putting, you know, a lot of money into these spaces, designing these concepts and creating these things and putting this money into other people's buildings. And I'm like, you know, my next step is starting to own property. And so I bought this space, and I was pretty excited about it because it did have a good foundation, and, the kitchen was beautiful, and we started working on that about almost a year ago. We actually had some little hiccups with the city, believe it or not. A lot of the zoning was incorrect. Like, I know they were vetting out the side building, and I had to rezone everything. And so we started moving on that. And then
what's that going to be? You have a concept, right?
Yeah, so that is Fish Nor Fowl.
Now, does that mean it's a steakhouse?
No.
What does it mean?
So Fish Nor Fowl means it's not a category. So this is probably going to be my biggest chef-driven restaurant to date. It's, you know, because all my other ones, like, you know, Poulet Bleu is French cuisine, and it's like I said, it's a balance of pushing it a little bit, but staying true to, like, bistro-style food. Tacos, you know, pork and beans is barbecue, you know, butcher is game, and, you know, meat is heavy gastropub burger. This is going to be whatever we want. It's going to be a simple, clean menu, and it's going to be whatever we really kind of feel like doing. It's going to be super creative. We're going to push the envelope here more than any other restaurant.
Who's going to be cooking? I mean, I saw you on the line the other night.
Yeah, I'm still on the line. I was on Garbage Day, actually. So I was making salads and tartars and
who's going to be the lead chef in your Fish Nor Fowl?
So Fish Nor Fowl is going to be Dan Carlton.
He's
been with Dan Carlton.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
So, I mean, he's been with me for, a long time. I mean, Dan worked at 909 with me, and then he did a little stint with Justin at Cure, and then he came back and opened up Butcher, and he's been at Butcher and Arise since then. And this is going to be, you know, Dan's first baby, where he's really, you know, he's in the front. You know, it's his name tagged on it, and it's time for him to shine. You know, he's been under my wing too long, and it's time to like kind of let him go and do his thing. And he's super creative, super talented, and I just think that'll be fun.
Looking forward to that one. And then two more you're planning. What are those?
So after that is we're doing called Gaijin. It's a space right next to Butcher and Arise, so it'll be connected to Butcher. It's a small footprint. It's about 1,200 square feet, and we're doing a really small, clean, modern take on Japanese / raw bar. So we're focusing on different raw. I mean, sometimes when I dine, it's, I mean, some of my favorite things to eat are raw. I mean, I'm always you know, tartars and carpaccios and sashimis. So it's going to be more composed raw dishes. So it's not going to be just, you know, maki rolls and things like that. It's just going to be really fun, creative raw dishes. And that's really going to be Dave Rezikoff. That's going to be his baby. I mean, that's right up. That's his forte.
He's so talented. And then there's one more. What's the other concept?
The last concept is called Coupe de Ville. Coupe de Ville is going to be a southern table, specialized in fried chicken. It's, we're going to put duck and bowling in there. It's a gigantic.
I imagined that. You're actually going to have bowling?
Yeah, so duck and bowling is like half the size. You know, I kind of want this like event. Like when I think of Pittsburgh, I'm always like, oh, you know, what does Pittsburgh need? What does Pittsburgh want? When we, you know, we need a really classic bistro, or we need a little taqueria. You know, here I think, you know, we need like this. We need event space, like sports bar-y. There's going to be video games in one section. There's going to be pool tables. There's going to be couches and lounge. It's going to be heavy, like sports-driven, like TVs. It's going to be really all southern, like fried chicken.
Do you know, I feel like I've already been there. One of the things I think, as we're wrapping this up, I think we ought to get something across is I keep in my mind what you said to me, that the joy of all this, it's forget about making money, forget about this and that and the other. You care about seeing people happy and having a good time. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, that's why, I mean, with chefs, that's our job. I mean, we're here to, you know, make people happy. And with places like Poulet Bleu being right in the action and sitting, actually working in the dining room, it's such a nice experience to be a chef because to interact and you see, you know, you get the questions, you get people coming behind, you know, checking off the line, you get, you know, you see the smiling faces, and it's such a nice change from being behind the line, behind everything in a closed-off kitchen. Even most kitchens that are even open are still set back to some degree, and, you know, and you're, but here you're like, in, you see everything. And for me, it's like, you know you've done something special when you see all the smiling faces, and you see people happy, and the buzz about Pittsburgh, and, you know, like I said, when I design these spaces, it's not always, it's sometimes, it's like, what do I think? What does Pittsburgh need? What do we need in this city that would, you know, we don't have that other cities have? And I try to, you know, bring these creations and these, you know, concepts to, you know, the city that I love so much. And when you see you get a good response from it, I mean, that's when, you know, I sleep well at night. And it's, you know, long hours. You know, I'm still doing dishes till 3 a.m. sometimes up in the dishwasher. And, it's a lot of work getting these things off, but when you see them come together and you see everyone happy, you see the buzz and you see the action, that's what I strive for. I think I'm addicted to that aspect of it. You know, you get the foundation, but it's the upkeep. I mean, and people don't understand, it's like I said, we have 300 some plus employees. It's behind the scenes, it's super hard. You know, it's creating a dish and, you know, painting a wall is one thing. But maintaining and, you know, staffing and, you know, people not coming in or calling off or not showing up or, I mean, it's just, you know, all the back, if they would follow me around for a day like a camera, what I have to deal with is just amazing. Like I said, it's just, It's all the details. I mean, coming in and my roof is leaking, and I'm up on a roof, and I'm bringing, you know, it's all these little things, you know. Then I'm at one place, and, you know, something starts happening at me at potatoes. You know, someone, a water line broke, you know, because it was cooled a couple weeks ago. And, you know, that's the hard part, is really juggling is all the behind the scenes that really
people
never
see. Well, you have two things going at minimum for you. Well, more than that. I mean, first of all, you have an artistic sensibility, which helps with this design thing. Secondly, you're creative and talented. Lots of ideas and lots of cooking skills. But the thing that really gets you through all this is you're a perfectionist. You have a touch of OCD as well, I think, because every little detail matters.
I think that's what pushes me to be, you know, get better and better and better. But it also, like, it's hard because I'm always looking at the negative. So it's like,
don't do that.
I'm not saying I'm not always happy. But, like, I mean, even with the Poulet Blue opening, like, I sit down every night, okay, what do you got, you know, and I start checking things off that I don't like. I don't like this. I don't want to like this. We need to fix this. We need to fix that. We need to fix, you know. And, but I think that's what drives you to be better. You know, being a perfectionist drives you to be, you know, not happy where you're at. You could always be better. Everyone could always be better. I mean, the restaurant could always be better. The food could be better. The service could be better. You know, the details. It's all the little details that separate something from a good restaurant and a great restaurant. And it's a hard process because, like I said, it's not only you doing all these little details. You're relying on everyone else to have the same, you know, image and everything that you have. So it's like, you know, trying to, you know, I mean, I walked through this place with the bartenders. I gave them a roller the other day. I'm like, make sure these bottles are lined up perfect. I mean, look at this behind the bar. I'm like, I could, like, why is your rag there? Why is, you know, and it drives me nuts. And it's trying to get, like, people to have the same passion.
But you had found time to talk to us about all this.
Here's the deal, listeners. Pittsburgh is proud of Rick Deschamps. Ann and Peter Hager are proud that he's our friend. And we wish him well.
Thank you. Thank you for, I appreciate everything you've done.
Okay.
On it, so.
So, Rick, thank you, and I'll talk to you soon.
And don't go away, because we'll be back in less than 20 seconds.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we're going to be talking to Lori Lynn Bauer. I want you to know that when this book arrived, I went, bleh, because I thought, oh, no, another book on sauces.
Yeah.
And then I cracked the cover of this book, which is beautiful anyhow. And it's called The Art of the Perfect Sauce. And I thought everybody should have access to this book. Buy it. Study it, use it.
Not only that, this lady's pet name is Lulu.
Oh, Lulu.
You have to buy a book written by Lulu. There's no question about that. Lulu was a pop singer in the 1970s.
Really?
Yeah. She sang the theme song for that movie with, it was somebody in the classroom. To Sir With Love was her big hit. Well, Lulu the Sauce Lady didn't do that, but she did something better.
She wrote a book.
Which has lasting value.
Well, I was surprised by this book. I mean, I didn't know because of the title, The Art of the Perfect Sauce, and we get so many sauce books, and I thought, uh-oh, yo-ho-hum. And then I picked it up and looked at it, and I was, what do you say, gobsmacked.
Gobsmacked.
Gobsmacked. So now that's why we're talking to Lori Lynn Bauer about this book. because I was just so flat out impressed, and I'm motivated to start making sauces out of it. So that's a good test, because I see many, many cookbooks, and this one stands out. Laurie, congratulations on this book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, you know, the old-style books on sauces, you even mentioned they concentrated on the mother sauces, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But then you said, you know, that's not altogether bad because there is a relationship here. But then you added so many new flavors and concepts and spark to the sauce basics that every one of them is like, oh, I'm really surprised to see these together.
Well, now for those dumb shits like me, go over those mother sauces.
Oh, okay, the mother sauces.
Okay. Well, do you know that? Well, let me just ask you: do you know the basics of the mother sauces? I mean, do you know how they came to be?
I don't know. Assume I don't know anything.
Well, there was a kind of a rock star chef. I think he was the first rock star chef. His name was actually Marie Antoine Carême. I'm probably going to butcher
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Okay.
And he was around about 1870s. I know he died around.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, I think he died about 1874 or so. And then Chef Escoffier built his concepts of what we recognize as the classic five mother sauces from what he created. And it's bechamel, espagnol, hollandaise, red sauce, and velouté.
Yes.
And then in 1960s, one of my biggest role models, Julia Child, introduced the French mother sauces to home cooks. And then it kind of took off a little bit, you know. And nowadays, there's what I call the new mother sauces. I mean, if you look all the cookbooks, all the blogs, everything you open, it has six basic types that have been appearing for like the last 10 years. And those are basically yogurt sauces, pepper sauce, herb sauce, tahini, kind of a tomato or salsa base, and a pesto. And once you master one of those, you know, it kind of allows you to comfortably change the ingredients and create dozens of variations from those.
Well, you break your sauces down. The first thing people are going to want to do, of course, is realize the importance of making good stock. And
yes.
We've certainly interviewed enough bone broth people. What is a bone broth? It's a stock. But anyhow, you start out with the techniques of sauces. You call it a sauce primer or primer. Which do you say?
And no, then, absolutely.
So how many of those, I mean, the people should master?
I think three of them is important. I think it's good to have a good vegetable stock, a good chicken, and a good beef stock. I usually will make these, and I keep them in my freezer. I have a lot, especially nowadays, we have a lot of friends and family who are gluten-free, who are vegans, vegetarians,
oh,
or
yes.
carnivores.
I know.
And, you know, you have these sauce, are my basis, my stocks, and they help me create a sauce or a dish around, you know, whoever my guest is.
Because you don't always know who it's going to be.
You know, and they don't always tell you till they get to your table.
Oh, isn't that awful?
Right,
yeah.
No,
it is what it is, you know. It just doesn't happen. Or you get kids come in and just like, oh, God, I don't eat that. It's yellow, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You just never know what you're going to get at your table. So you have to, you know, you have to be flexible. But knowing how to make a good meat, chicken, and vegetable stock, I mean, it's not just for sauces. It's also for soups and for braising liquids
yes.
and, you know, pretty much everything you do.
Yeah, a question. You recommend, lots of people recommend that you can freeze these for up to a certain period of time. I always freeze them for longer. I mean, how long can you freeze them for?
Well, you know, I've never used anything over 6 months because I tend to find it tastes a little off to me.
Oh, yeah, but 6 months is very different from 3 weeks.
No. I usually can get about 6 months out of mine.
Yeah, good.
I have no problems with 6 months. It depends, I think, on how you package it. I tend to buy commercial plastic containers, and I seal it really tight, and I
That's
label
good.
It. So
yeah.
I think a lot of people open it, they smell it, they put it back in the freezer, and they ruin the seal. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, a nice layer of popsicle on top of my stock.
Now, there was one real important piece of advice early in the book, which said, don't salt your stock.
Oh, yeah, that's important.
No,
yeah.
Don't ever salt never salt your stock.
So listen up, listeners. Don't salt your stock, huh?
There
you go.
No.
That I never understood that. I mean, the people didn't understand that they were going to boil down.
A lot of people don't understand. I don't understand. How,
sure you did.
I don't understand half the things you told me.
As a whole, as a generation, we tend to oversalt things anyway. I mean, it doesn't make you crazy when people come to your table and salt before they've even tasted it.
I got one of those.
I know that you undersalt. But you have then, you go into, the basic sauces. You have pan sauce, you have a simmer sauce, thickened sauce, emulsified, whisked. These are new categories for me. I mean, I understand them when I'm reading them. I would never have been able to figure that out. Gastrique, I mean, organizing them this way. Mignonettes, I never thought of that as a category for itself, but then you give us some really exciting mignonettes. Compound butter, which is a really important thing currently, everybody's into that. And then your thickeners, you list as separate.
Yes.
Roux, the number of people who don't know what a roux is, of course, there are people who never went to New Orleans, I guess. The Burmese, whatever. And I just had an episode with mussels where they listed the Burmese on the mussels, but didn't understand that that is something totally different from pouring in all this cream.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. So, anyhow, so you do that. Then you have really interesting a sauce table. You list the sauces that are in your book with the page references, and then what the sauce will go with: poultry, meat, fish, vegetables, and pasta, desserts.
On the page reference is a dish. I mean, it's the sauce and the dish that you put it on.
Yes, exactly.
Very
that came to be because both Ramin and I have had people ask us, you know, they get a cookbook or they see a great recipe for something, and then I get a phone call, I say, what would this go with? And I started to realize that a lot of the cookbooks that I own, you know, you'll find something wonderful. And me as a professional chef, it's a little easier for me to create and figure out the pairing than it would be maybe for a home cook. So we wanted people to feel comfortable if they made this to know that it would pair well with different things.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of these sauces, I think, reading your recipes, I'd pair them with a lot more things.
And I'm going to guess which one was probably one of your favorites. I'm going to guess it might have been the coconut cream and turmeric because I listen to your show,
yeah.
And I know that you tend to like turmeric.
I love turmeric. Yeah, I do.
She's a turmeric freak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what I saw that sauce, and I was like, kind of laughing. I was actually thinking about you guys when that went in the book.
So
it's nice because you know you can cook. You can gently saute a chicken in it, or you can pour it over a poultry. You can put it over fish. You know, you're only limited by your imagination, and then you can add different things to it.
You have plenty of imagination, I must say. Well, you and your co-author. Your co-author, Ramin, how do you?
Her name is Ramin Ganeshram, and she is wonderful.
Yes, she worked with you on this cookbook. She is, and
she's written several books. She's written children's books and other cookbooks before,
really?
And she's got such a fascinating background. Her mother is Persian Iranian, and her father is from Trinidad.
Wow!
And I'm telling you, the food that I've had at her table, we knew that we were going to be writing partners.
Oh, that's great. Now,
we've always gotten along really well, and a lot of our food complements. I'll come up with something, she'll come up with something that goes well with it. We're peanut butter and jelly. We get along really well, and we love to write together. So I've been very blessed to find her.
Now, you're also going to have a blog together too, right?
Yes, we're creating a blog right now. We're in the works of that. And then customers or anybody who buys this book and the next one that we're thinking about, they're able to reach out to us. And you can come up with questions or concerns, and you can actually help drive the blog. Maybe there's something that you'd like us to see us create on this blog. You'll be able to reach out to us. We just wanted something out there. She and I both have the kind of – we like to help people. We like to help people in the kitchen and other aspects of the life. And
do you know how time-consuming this blogging stuff is?
You know, it is, and she and I both had to give it a lot of thought. I don't think either one of us would have the time to do it just on our own. But she is an amazing writer, and I tend to be more the creative in the kitchen type. So I'm coming up with these things, and she's helping me. We just work so well together. We both have, you know, different things that we bring to it. And we've already got the format designed, and we're just trying to get a few blogs ahead before we actually post it. So it'll be up in about 2 or 3 weeks. So we're very excited.
Now, let's open the kimono just a little bit, because you spent several years on Iron Chef.
I was. Kat Cora and Iron are chefing dear friends.
With Kat Cora, who used to love to dish it to the guys, right?
Yes.
We've interviewed Kat.
Now, is it real?
It is real. We don't know what the secret ingredient is until literally 5 minutes, right when they shoot. And, you know, people are always saying, well, you know, they don't discuss it. Well, what they do is they shoot the secret ingredient, they stop the show, they let the audience go to the bathroom, and we discuss what we're going to do in that 5 minutes, and then go. You have 1 hour in which to cook that secret ingredient.
Wow.
And the reason you have that beauty shot that you have to plate is because they film it, and then you have an hour in which to, you know, present your food to the judges, but you cannot recook, only reheat things.
Oh,
it's
boy.
Incredibly stressful and a lot of fun. We had a great time on that show.
Now, here's another question for you, and I don't think it's an unfair question. We had on our show two chefs who were actually twins. They're Chinese, and they inherited a Chinese restaurant in Manchester, England. And they were really, really remarkable. They were actually invited to cook at 10 Downing Street.
Wow.
For the Premier of China when he came to visit Prime Minister Cameron. But we asked them, because they were discovered by Gordon Ramsay. So we said, well, secretly, what's Gordon Ramsay really like? and they said, he's a perfect gentleman. He doesn't swear. All that stuff is for the camera.
It is for the camera.
Now, is there some little secret like that you can tell us about Iron Chef?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot that you don't see. They edit out a lot.
I'm sure they do.
The battle is for an hour, and then each team has an hour in which to present. That is 3 hours, right?
Yes.
And then they have to edit it down to an hour with commercials. So there is a lot of things that get edited out, and they play things up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at the gentleman who plays the what is his name? Even Alton Brown and these gentlemen who
are in the commentary,
they come across as so crazy and off the wall, and they're perfectly lovely people, and they push you to be a little bit crazy on that show.
Uh-huh. And well,
makes good
TV. For interest, yeah, makes good
yeah.
TV.
They want you to be interesting. There's the word interesting.
Yeah. Now I'm just. Because I've been saying how on top of the concept that there's the delicious sauces recipes that are in this book, and I just wanted to mention some of those because our listeners like that kind of thing. They want the equivalent of food porn. One of the ones that really caught my eye was the Persian pomegranate and walnut sauce.
Uh-huh.
Fezanjan. What is it?
Yep.
Tell us about that.
It's in June, and Ramin used to make this all the time. And what's wonderful about this sauce is that it's good on pheasant, quail, chicken, or duck.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Wonderful on a lot of different, and it's delicious.
I want that. I really want to make that.
You need to make that.
And so tell us some of the other ones.
One of my favorites is one called the Sharif. It's a spicy sauce. It's based Middle Eastern, the kind of North African Jewish cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And it has tomato, but it has a couple of different kinds of peppers in it. It has the Aleppo pepper as well as the red hot cherry peppers. And it kind of has like a fruity, complex flavor.
Uh-huh.
And what I like about it is I can drizzle it over the sauce, the food when it's done, or I can use it as a dipping sauce, or I can use it to baste. A lot of our sauces can be used for multiple things.
Yes, that's really a good thing.
Like the Cuban mojo is a marinade or sauce.
Yeah, I like that one too.
The fennel tangerine vinaigrette, you know, you can marinate with that as well.
And the other one, I love this. I never even thought of something like this. Szechuan peppercorn mignonette with your oysters.
Yes.
Now that's
I like the
fabulous.
Szechuan peppercorns. Have you had them before?
Yes, I love them.
I think they're delicious, and a lot of people don't know about them. But they've got that little, you know, they've got that kind of peppery, kind of floral scent, and they're not as spicy as people would think, and they're absolutely delicious. Ramin and I both cook similarly. We cook with a kind of a layering of flavors.
Yes.
So that, you know, same thing, we bring that to our sauces. You know, you should get one taste at the tip of your tongue, and, you know, and then it follows a little bit more, and then, but by the time you've swallowed it, you should have had at least been able to pick up a couple of different flavors from our sauces.
Now tell me about this casserole.
I'm sorry, say this again?
Yeah, I'm not pronouncing it right. Kasarip.
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 Spell it.
C-A-S-S-A-R-E-E-P. Pan sauce. It's Pinot Noir and Kasarip.
It's delicious. And what's nice about it is that it can be served. I've served that before on pork. I've also done it on vegetables. And I've also served it as a dessert sauce. You know what I find that a lot of these sauces, if you change the sugar content or maybe add a little bit of chili or something to bring up the heat, you can really change what you use it for. I don't think people taste their sauces enough. I think you make something, you take a spoonful of it, you taste it on its own before you serve it. And then you kind of adjust it to your own flavors.
I give it to Anne and say, check this out. Tell me if it needs more salt.
but that's actually important because, you know, a lot of things are under-seasoned.
I don't want to be responsible for putting something on the table that she's not going to like.
But here's the thing. As a chef, you're always looking for a way to create maximum flavor with minimum effort, right? And I find that the right sauce can elevate any dish. It can improve and balance flavor, and it can really help compensate for under-seasoning. It can add moisture to lean food or when you use a cooking technique like grilling or sautéing. You know, it gives you the texture, and it can provide a striking, visual contrast to a dish. It's nothing like seeing a beautiful, like, Romanesca on a plate.
Oh, I love Romanesca,
We have one in here that's a smoked tomato.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. It is so delicious, I'm telling you.
Is that the one that's slathered on the chicken?
Yes.
I've
got to tell you, though, one of my favorites one is, it's funny, it's the one that the pitcher didn't turn out the best on. There's a slow-roasted tomato and chirignola olive relish. And these chirignola olives are these big, green, meaty olives. And I slice
real bright green, those.
Oh, they're delicious.
Yeah.
They're not as salty. And when you slow-roast the tomatoes with the thyme and the garlic, and then I add the fresh lemon and with this olive, it's a gorgeous relish. And, I mean, I can serve it on a crostini or on polenta as well as fish or chicken. And it holds in the refrigerator. That's what I think a lot of people don't realize as well. You can make extra sauce, hold it up, and then gently, reheat it if it's a pan sauce the day that you want it. I find a lot of my sauces pick up flavor by being in the refrigerator overnight.
Huh. And makes these little bowls for breakfast every morning. There's nothing like that, in which case boiled eggs will have to do. So,
well, a boiled egg with a nice little bit of that chimichurri was actually quite delicious.
Well, no, hold on
I'm
a second.
Try that.
Hold on a second, because I never thought she would do this. I actually had a little bit of pan sauce left from the lamb chops.
That I
cooked on Valentine's Day. And guess what? She had it on her lentils for breakfast this morning.
That's what I'm telling you. People don't realize you make extra sauce, and then you use it the next day in a different way,
You know.
If you're having roast chicken, you do the hoisin habanero. Then the next day, you're putting it on a little bit of pasta.
I think, though, that some of your photography is totally criminal, like this guava and ginger glaze on the stack of donuts. Single-handedly,
so
you boosted
the
obesity craze. Oh, boy.
Hey, do you guys make compound butters?
I have. I don't all the time.
Are you a fan of them, or?
It's okay. It depends on what, if I'm doing something that I find boring, like steaks, I won't do one.
I want you to make the runny fruit compound butter. And I want you to split the butter in half and divide the recipe. I want you to add chili to one of them and then chili nut to the other. And then I use a sweeter one for like pancakes and waffles or if I have a pound cake. But the one with the chili, I use on a chicken breast right off the grill or out of the oven.
Nice.
Or, on a steak. It's amazing just adding a little bit of spice to that sweet fruit, how it changes the whole profile of sauce.
Oh, great. Well, I think this is wonderful. One part's more exciting than the next, and one recipe more tempting than the one before. So we're going to have a lot of fun with this book. Once again, it's Lori Lynn Bauer and Ramin
Ganeshram.
The book is entitled The Art of the Perfect Sauce, and you'll get 75 of these very creative and very versatile sauce recipes. So good luck with this book, Lori Lynn.
It's like Lulu's my nickname, so it's okay.
Oh, Lulu. Oh, yeah. Okay,
no,
Lori Lynn.
It's
thank you so much, and have a good time here, too.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Last stop, Rita Serrano does not sound much like a Dutch name, but actually our next guest is from Holland, and I imagine she has a complicated genealogy involving various Mediterranean countries. She is has always been, apparently, veggie-centric to vegan, and her book is straightforward, vegan in seven, meaning seven ingredients. Well, now, this is someone, Rita Serrano, who has so much experience with plant-based cooking and eating. it's really amazing. You have a book called Vegan in Seven.
Yes,
delicious,
that's right.
Plant-based recipes in seven ingredients or fewer. But boy, you've been all over the board with the plant-based. You were raised in an
biotic?
Yes, diet.
Yes. It's plant-based eating is in my blood.
Yes, I would say.
Yes, yes. It's been from child on. I've always been accustomed to eating plants, and that's what I still do, and feed my family with this kind of food, which I find, it's for me and my family, it's great, and it gives us energy, and yeah, we feel good about it.
That's great.
But now you live in the Netherlands, in the capital city of Amsterdam.
I do.
In Amsterdam.
I do at the moment, yeah.
I thought the Dutch like cheese. In fact, they like cheese that has red on the outside.
yes. Actually, it's true that the Dutch people are known for eating and drinking, eating lots of cheese and drinking lots of milk. That's true. But I'm not one of them, let's say. And I was not raised on the, like, say, typical Dutch diet.
No.
So, No. My parents had a more, they were more like, early hippies.
Yeah.
And I ate brown rice and whole grains and beans and vegetables.
No, I hope you have a bicycle.
I do.
Good.
Yes.
We're trying to make sure that you're not just a fake Dutch person.
No. I do have a bicycle, and the whole family has a bicycle, and my girl already cycles to school like 8 kilometers.
Oh, really?
So real Dutch.
And all the Dutch people except yourself are now in South Korea.
There are only a few. The fastest.
Applauding all the speed skaters.
Well, did you hear the flap about Katie Couric?
I know she's in I know she's in Korea, but I don't know any more than that.
No, she said you're all wondering why all the great speed skaters are from Holland, and she said it's because they have all those canals, and they when it freezes, they have to skate around it.
Yeah, I think that's true.
It's not true at all.
No, we're longing for a real winter. Actually, it's been too long could skate on the canals. But
we're going to send you some of ours right now.
Yeah, we've had enough.
Okay, yes, please. A real winter.
We got nothing else. Now the seven. Now I was a little confused. I thought, Boy, this lady is really smart because she's produced a whole book with only seven ingredients.
Oh, come on, man.
But
the seven comes in the individual recipes.
Yes, the seven comes in individual recipes. I could have done a cookbook with only, say, chickpea recipes, but
yeah, right.
I thought that was maybe kind of boring. So I reduced it down to seven or fewer, and just to show people that actually it's quite easy and still tasty to eat this way and accessible, because there's not a lot of weird ingredients, and they're seasonal, so good on the budget, and they're easy. So yeah, that's why seven, not to make it too, you know, if there's already a list of 20 ingredients, it might be a bit daunting. It's like, oh, do I really need all those things to get started? And no, I just wanted to make it easy and attractive to get cooking.
Let's take a second on chickpeas, because chickpeas are so essential, I guess, to a vegan, a vegetarian diet. And we discovered not too long ago that you can actually buy them fresh here locally.
But it's
so much trouble to peel the membrane off.
Oh, it's too much. And then
that's
a lot of work. I can imagine. I never had them.
They're very cute. We've seen them growing on a tree. There are two of these peas per pod.
You know, wow.
Yeah, and of course the pods are all over the tree.
Here's the interesting thing. Next thing along, we discovered that our local Whole Foods food store actually stocks frozen chickpeas, flash frozen chickpeas.
Wow. Yeah, that's better than the
canned.
They're really good.
Fresh, I can imagine.
They're really good, but they're very expensive.
Yeah, but you know, you lose something.
Yeah.
You lose the, what is the aqua, liquid.
Hold on. I'm coming on to the next thing.
Okay.
Now, then we discovered, from somebody telling us this, that the canned chickpeas,
aquafaba,
which is what we usually buy, the liquid that they're in is aquafaba.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be really good for you.
Well, not, you can whip it like whipped cream.
Actually, yes, it's whippable, and it resembles egg white. So there are people who use it for making fluffy pancakes, for vegan meringue, to use it in even like vegan omelets to have this fluffy texture. And for a no waste, if you're doing no waste and you can use this for egg substitute, don't throw it away.
No.
But the problem is, if you want some to make an omelet today, what do you do with the chickpeas you've taken out of the can?
Then you roast them and make like little chickpea croutons from that I wrote in the book.
good. All right.
Let's step back a bit. You have your introduction, and then you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 sections.
Yes.
Start fresh, fast, nourish, gather, sweet, and basic. Do you want to explain that to us?
Yes, so I divided the book in several recipes. Of course, you have to make a decision in how you see the book, and some do it in a seasonal way, and I decided to do it this way. So we start with the beginning of bidet, and then moving along into recipes that can be done fast, like within 20 minutes. And I wrote fresh, which are typically more summery dishes that are just like salads and soups and so on. And nourish are more recipes that are nice in winter, warming, and you can do them in the oven, and they're really nourishing for the body, and what you need when it's cold outside and you want to just come home to a warm bowl of good food. And then gather, I wrote especially because if there's lots of people, vegans starting out, and of course vegans also have friends or family that don't eat vegan, and I think it's always nice to bring something, not discussing the way you eat, but just showing how you eat and showing people like, okay, it can be really fun or delicious eating this way. So Gather is really to show like it's nice to share food and sweet, well, yeah. Sweet. Everybody loves sweets.
Except me.
And well, most people like sweets. Most people like sweets. And then in our family, we also like, I mean, I have a 7-year-old daughter who's crazy about olives. If I do a cake, she's like, okay, but can I have some nuts or an olive? But most people eat sweets. So it's the way to someone's heart, as they say. And I wanted to write some recipes that are wholesome and still indulgent without using refined sugars. And Basics is really a chapter that includes recipes that you can use every day and has really staple recipes for modern vegan cooking. Like there's a cashew cream in it which can turn sweet or salty and savory, and this cream you can use instead of like a cream sauce. If you heat it, it becomes like a cream sauce, or for in your pasta, or you can use it as a base for, let's say, like a more cream cheese. If you add like garlic and spices to it, or herbs, and Basics are really those recipes that you can use every day. So that's the recipe section.
You know, you are very, very creative with your recipes, but I think you've worked at it for a long time, getting all these ingenious ideas. You know, even though you started out with a macrobiotic, but you then, as I guess teen or just past teenage, started eating junk food and got ill. You got really sick. You had psoriasis and whatnot.
Yes.
And the doctors weren't helping. Yeah.
Serious.
So, but then I didn't know you started Kung Fu, but I didn't understand what Kung Fu, I didn't know there was a dietary component to Kung Fu.
Well, there isn't, but if you train for more than, like, we train for like 20, 24 hours in a week.
Oh, jeez.
Then you're asking really something from your body, and you are looking for ways how to feel more energized and more healthy. And you don't, if you eat something and you feel like, oh, now I want to sit on the couch for another 2 hours, it doesn't help. And so... So I was really searching for foods that gave me enough energy and stamina, and still because in Kung Fu if you work from the outside, you're working on getting softer, and we did a particular style Kung Fu which also does a qigong in it, so it's also a health part in a health aspect of Kung Fu. Then you also really are looking for ways to feel more healthy, and you can't get, I mean, you feel sluggish if you eat processed food. So I was looking for ways to feel better energized and healthier.
Now you have a garden as well, but the garden's in another country. Can you explain that? Seems like, why did you have to go all the way to France to have a garden?
Okay. Yeah, I lived for a long time in Amsterdam, and it's a city, and we lived in me and my husband were living in a small apartment, a really small apartment, and we were working there. And when I got pregnant, we bought a home a few years before I got pregnant, and we went there for a couple of days in a month because we both had our own jobs and were our own bosses and own firms. And then I got pregnant, and the apartment was too small, and we decided to give this child, this baby of ours, something more natural and another environment. And I was already into cooking, of course, but I was dreaming about having my own garden and going outside and having seasonal food and just running around with your child in nature, so to say. So we lived there for four years, and I had my garden, and we lived in a nice village. And and when she got older, we realized that schooling wasn't that great in the country.
Got it. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, so it was homeschooling, but well, for us, it was like, okay, it's also nice for a child to have like friends, and so we decided to move back. We still have the house. We still go there. But having a garden isn't easy. You really have to be there a lot to grow your own vegetables.
Oh, I know. We tried this.
Yeah. I have a feeling there's a book about gardening somewhere in your future.
I hope. I really love seasonal vegetables, and I think they're so underrated, and we are so used now to eating like strawberries all year round, and it's not the time of strawberries right now, but we can get them. And eating seasonal for me is really, it's key for being healthy and also affordable. And I think there's a reason that it grows at this certain time of the year. For me, it's the local, it's the local seasonal food that's really the superfood we need.
Well, this, listeners, this is a beautiful book, beautiful pictures, beautiful concepts behind the recipes. Absolutely delicious looking.
She does amazing things.
Almost enough for Peter to turn from carnivore to vegan. But we're not quite there yet.
No, but it's also to inspire people to eat more vegetables. If you're not a vegan and want to give it a try or eat more plants or eat more more wholesome and not so processed, I really wanted to show easy recipes that are fun to do and easy to do. And I wanted to write really a book that could be used instead of being there on the shelf and say like, oh, it's a pretty book, but it's too hard, or I don't feel like.
Well,
it's
the stuff looks good, the food looks great, and I could just from the ingredients tell that it's good, that the flavors are going to be like lentil and porcini ragu to be wonderful. It would make you fennel and saffron stew, the green quinoa balls. Yeah. I mean, they're wonderful, wonderful concepts for recipes.
Thank you. I really tried. I think it's really about giving flavor to food. I mean, especially for people that are used to eating processed food or even like steaks and everything. They are so accustomed to having strong flavors, and that's often what they miss and they say that, oh, it's so bland, but it isn't. I mean, plant-based food or vegan food can be exciting and tasty, and especially if you know how to add those flavors to the food and deepen flavors, like with the porcini and lentils too. I mean, the dried porcini really gives depth of flavor. And yeah, I've been cooking such a long time, but I really enjoy giving good flavor to food, and that people in the end say like, oh wow, this is really something really nice, and I didn't even notice there wasn't any meat in it.
This is like with every recipe in this book. You've really accomplished a lot, Rita Serrano. Again, the title,
you.
Vegan in 7, Delicious Plant-Based Recipes in 7 Ingredients or Fewer. And I think you are. It's an inspirational book.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I really hope so.
I want this snail dish.
Oh, yeah, the shiitake snail. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. Yeah. It's also good to have a laugh about food and nice.
Yeah,
I mean,
there is humor in a lot of these preparations.
And have humor in it. Listen, yeah, true, true.
We're going to be still going to be talking tomorrow if we don't hang up.
Oh, I can talk for hours about food.
Bye, Rita Serrano.
Okay, thank you so much.
Bye,
thank
Rita.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for talking to us.
So there you have it. Another week, another program in the bag, another week until we see you again, but we hope we will. Same time, same place, and until then.
Bye-bye.